coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware was handed a failing grade in a new study of transparency and ethics in state government.
What we're doing is depriving the public of the opportunity to look over our shoulders.
Political reporter James Dawson stops by to help us understand the grade. Helen Farr Sloan is perhaps best known as the second wife of realist, painter, and illustrator John Sloan. Thanks to her, the Delaware Art Museum is home to the largest collection of his work.
Also, she would go out to auction and buy things that she thought we were interested in. So we have an extraordinary collection of French turn-of-the-century posters. She bought us contemporary art, so her legacy here was really quite extraordinary.
Farr Sloan was also an accomplished artist, and in our arts playlist, we take you to Wilmington for an exhibition of her work. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about a new withdrawal management center serving Kent and Sussex counties, examine the potential for more nuisance flooding in coming years, and meet a UD researcher examining how to keep women in STEM-related fields. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A new survey of transparency and ethics policies found glaring gaps in Delaware's governmental accountability system, earning the state a failing grade and placing it near the bottom of all 50 states. The 2015 State Integrity Investigation by the Center for Public Integrity and Global Integrity ranked Delaware 48th, one of 11 states with an F grade. Delaware Public Media political reporter James Dawson took a closer look at the report and reaction to it this week.
Much of that poor grade stems from state lawmakers carving out disclosure exemptions for themselves, a lack of digital access to public documents, and an anemic oversight agency. The Public Integrity Commission, charged with collecting state lawmaker, judicial, and governmental official disclosure forms, is run by two people. Legislators cut their budget 2.6% in July amid a stagnant revenue climate and extended negotiations among legislators. Deborah Moreau heads the office and says she, along with other department heads, were asked to cut back on costs to make it through the most recent fiscal year. But Moreau said she didn't anticipate that becoming permanent.
I really am disappointed by the cut in our funding because it almost seems like the reward for financial responsibility is to have your budget cut, and I don't think that's the message that they want to send.
One of the biggest dark spots in Delaware's Sunshine Law envelops all of Legislative Hall. When the General Assembly pried open the doors to conduct public budget hearings and broaden the Freedom of Information Act, they excluded the release of their own emails and that of their staff, something Representative John Kowalko frequently criticizes.
What we're doing is depriving people, the public, of the opportunity to look over our shoulders. And, you know, they paid the price of admission to look over our shoulders to see what we're doing.
A statement from Governor Jack Markell's office says, quote, "While we have more work to do, Delaware government and the people involved in politics are more accountable to the public than ever before," end quote. John Flaherty, head of the Delaware Coalition for Open Government, agrees with Markell in most respects, but Flaherty says the poor funding of the Public Integrity Commission leaves the state without an ethical overseer, especially because state lawmakers police themselves with internal ethics commissions handling violations.
Right now, we really have no watchdog of the Delaware General Assembly.
James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
And Delaware Public Media political reporter James Dawson joins us now here on The Green to talk a little bit more about this report. James, thanks for being with us.
Sure thing, Tom.
Well, as you sought reaction to this report earlier this week, did you sense that the grade, the F grade, came as a big surprise to the people you talked to?
I mean, some of them were a bit surprised that Delaware was so far down in the rankings, yeah, but advocates for a more open government really weren't shocked by the news. If you deal with state government for any length of time, you'll really find that there are easy ways for any official or politician to hide information from you if they want to. For example, if you're looking for emails on policy discussions within an agency, if they simply just add one member of the state legislature or even any of their staff, all of that communication is protected from public records requests, period. The judiciary is also a big one. If any ethical complaints about a judge are made, all members of the state Supreme Court and the heads of Delaware's other four courts go behind closed doors and rule on any punishment that may or may not come. And reporters and citizens can't get any sort of minutes or anything that you normally would from an open meeting, even after the fact. People who I talked to that were surprised say that they felt that way because Of some of the reforms that have been made in the past few years that have improved the Freedom of Information Act, but those really weren't enough to make much progress with what we found in the investigation.
And I guess that's what I was going to get to, is that I'm sure some in state government, including the Markell administration, feel like they didn't get a whole lot of credit for some of the work that they've done previously, particularly on campaign finance reform. And even as you mentioned in the piece we just heard, John Flaherty from the Delaware Coalition for Open Government says some positive things about recent efforts. I guess why didn't Delaware get maybe a little bit more credit for some of the things it has done?
So they did get some credit for it, but it just wasn't enough to move the needle forward. Keep in mind, this is a gigantic survey. We have 250 questions that range from accountability at all levels of government to pension fund management, ethics enforcement, and different areas like that. The questions made about keeping FOIA requests affordable for the public was only in a handful of those questions. So the state also got dinged because there have been documented cases of two agencies still withholding information from a reporter and a citizen after they filed records requests. And they eventually had to appeal to the Attorney General to get that information to them. Most recently, in my mind, this was in July, a blogger requested, to be fair, a mountain of information from the Department of Education.
Right.
And they tried to stick him with a $6,500 bill to really compile all that information. He appealed. The AG's office found that the bill wasn't reasonable and cut nearly $5,000 off of that total. And in that example, you can see that the new law does work eventually, but it still can be a systemic problem that needs more attention.
And as you mentioned in your online piece at DelawarePublic.org, the last time there was a report from the Center for Public Integrity of this type, Delaware got a C-. But you also mentioned you really can't draw a direct comparison between the two grades. Why is that? Why are these two reports so different?
Well, the reason is because Center for Public Integrity and Global Integrity shifted some of the focus of this report towards ease of access for information. Obviously, technology has just exploded. Over the past year, if you're a tech nerd like me, or over the 3 years since this was last done. So they shifted that towards ease of access for information. They dropped some questions and even a whole category. They took out electoral redistricting, for example, because that really only happens every 10 years
right. Anyway.
So you certainly can look at parts of this report to see if any progress has been made, like there was a little bit in lobbying disclosure. But overall, it really wouldn't be fair to compare the two.
And I guess you mentioned the one thing you mentioned, technology. I mean, it sounds like because of the advances in technology, perhaps those watchdog groups like this are maybe raising the bar a little bit higher for access, that because the technology is there to make it more accessible, it should be made more accessible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, if you can simply put a PDF with hundreds of pages of information on whatever it might be online for people to look at, you don't have to worry about them coming into your office and taking up all this time with, maybe an administrative assistant going back and copying all these pages physically. That takes time away from whatever they might do.
Or even just going back to paper records and having to like literally pull out file boxes and find things.
Exactly.
You can now
and that's
search
what I'm
things.
Saying. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's what I was trying to get at. It does seem like that there's a little bit more of an ask here because there is a little bit more ease of answering those requests. Let's take a look at where states like Delaware can improve. I assume from what I heard in your report, the Public Integrity Commission is probably a place to start.
Yeah, I'd say that's a fairly good place to start. So nearly 60% of their budget goes toward the salaries of the two people actually running the office. And when you add in the 2.6% cut of everything else that lawmakers made in July to that specific budget, that becomes pretty substantial. However, just giving the commission more money without direction isn't going to solve anything. When I spoke with Deborah Moreau, who heads the office, she said if they got any extra funding, she's not going to put it towards auditing financial disclosure forms for public officials and legislators. And we've seen problems there in the past. So you've had sitting lawmakers, current, except gifts over $250 that is the reporting threshold right now, and not disclose it on those reports. You have Senator Dave Sekola, who got tickets to Philadelphia Eagles football game that weren't disclosed. Senate Majority Leader David McBride frequently picked up cases of expensive vodka from a donor on his way to the beach in the summer. He does dispute that it was more than, you know, two or three times, but a case of this particular vodka is fairly expensive, you know, by itself. And then Senator Colm Bonini didn't report employees from a liquor distributor, NKS, helping him put up campaign signs while they were being paid during work hours. And despite that, Moreau told me that if three out of the more than 300 reports made an error, which she says on it, then it's a pretty good accuracy rating. She also doesn't want to make disclosure reports available online. You can go into the office and get them, but they're not available online. She says that they're going to use people might use that information to scam officials, but anyone in elected office already makes their home addresses, emails, phone numbers public when they file paperwork with the state when they run.
So I guess a lot of this just goes back to like how much teeth is there behind whatever work is being done to watch elected officials and others in state government.
Exactly.
We've talked a lot about FOIA during this discussion, and there are these exemptions that we've discussed carved out for legislators and to a lesser extent UD and DSU in terms of what you can ask for, what information is available. Tell us a little bit about what they are and what is the explanation for having these exemptions carved out?
Sure. So like I said, any email sent to a lawmaker or their staff member is confidential, and there's no way you're seeing any of it unless you get it outside of a public records request. There are certain lawmakers who make their emails public if you ask for them, but they're few and far between. Lawmakers say they need that exemption because of private constituent relations matters. Some of them have told me they get emailed social security numbers, driver's license numbers, and all kinds of private information. But really, the state already redacts information in these records requests, and there's no difference in covering up this sensitive material. As for University of Delaware and Delaware State University, they don't have to disclose anything in terms of construction projects or operating expenses if they don't involve public money. You can't see their emails. But back to the public money part, in that respect, you kind of have to trust that they aren't moving taxpayer funds around in their budget if they deny your records request. There have been efforts to try and nix that exemption that the universities have carved out, but it's faced heavy opposition from the schools and hasn't gone anywhere at all.
With that in mind, is there some low-hanging fruit still available for lawmakers to grab? Specifically, you hear a lot about that report from former Delaware Supreme Court Chief Justice Norman Vesey from 2 years ago. Some of that was acted on. A number of groups, including Common Cause, there's still more there that can be done from that report. Is that still kind of low-hanging fruit that could be worked on beyond some of these like bigger ones that obviously are not likely to get taken care of in a very short period of time?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the easiest things the General Assembly could do would be to finally include themselves in laws that make it illegal for them to use state resources for personal gain. They've also exempted themselves from nepotism, cronyism, and patronage laws when hiring legislative staff. Family members of public officials can really be used to funnel gifts from donors or lobbyists, but we wouldn't know it because they don't have to file annual disclosure forms. I think because Delaware earns such a poor grade, you could print out all of 250 of these questions, line them up as a target, aim a shotgun at them, and you would find like a handful of areas that could be vastly improved.
And I think the question I have more immediately is, I mean, you look at the next year, particularly election year, budget deficit, we've talked about this before. There's not a whole lot of likelihood any of this is going to get looked at short term, particularly in this current session.
Well, I'm wondering, so you have the university FOIA exemption bill. That's still active. We could see some movement on that, maybe. I don't know. As far as restoring cuts to the Public Integrity Commission, that's a possibility because it was only a few thousand dollars that were cut. And if we see any sort of gains in revenue, I would imagine that revelation coming out might be a little embarrassing to some people. So they might try and funnel some more resources there.
I was going to say, theoretically, there would be some interest in going after low-hanging fruit because it would be a good issue for your election to say, hey, look, I did open up government some more, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
All right. James Dawson, our political reporter, thank you so much for being with us on The Green this week.
Thank you, Tom.
And a reminder, you can find all of James's coverage of politics and government anytime at DelawarePublic.org. Stay with us. The Green continues in a moment with a look at a new detox and rehab center opening in Harrington to serve Kent and Sussex counties. This is Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. As the landscape of drug and alcohol abuse evolves in Delaware, so do its treatment centers. Wilmington-based Connections Community Support Programs expanded downstate this week with the opening of a new bricks-and-mortar withdrawal management center in Harrington. It'll provide traditional inpatient detox, but with new breeds of drug abuse cropping up in both Kent and Sussex counties and pervasive stigma surrounding getting treatment, leaders say they're also focusing on a more flexible approach to recovery. Delaware Public Media's Annie Ropeek spoke with Connections Community Director Kathy McKay to learn more.
Can you just start by telling me a little bit about what a withdrawal management center does? What kind of services do these provide generally?
Sure. So, you know, historically they've been called detox centers or detoxification centers with the idea that people, you know, again, historically have gone to them because they were withdrawing from alcohol or benzodiazepines or some other sedative hypnotic type drug that can present a physiological as well as psychological danger from withdrawal. And so detoxification sort of referred to managing that withdrawal so that they didn't have seizures or other negative medical effects, because withdrawal from alcohol and barbiturates and benzodiazepines can be fatal. But recently, a lot of the people who have been going to detox centers have been going with addictions to opioid drugs, including heroin, but also some of the ones that are available by prescription, like OxyContin and Percocet and oxycodone. Withdrawal from those drugs is very uncomfortable but not fatal, so you can do it without medical assistance, but most people don't do it without some kind of replacement therapy because it's so uncomfortable. So the new thinking is pretty much that a withdrawal management center can do both things. It can help somebody detoxify from alcohol or benzodiazepines or a drug like that, or it can help somebody transition from the use of street opioids to the use of medications that are used to treat opioid addiction, like methadone or Suboxone. So this new withdrawal management center is kind of a new concept for Delaware anyway. I'm sure they're doing it in other places.
Sure. And so is this an inpatient center?
Yeah, it has. Well, it's got three components. It has 23-hour beds, which are for people who maybe need some observation to determine their level of need, to make sure that they don't need medically monitored withdrawal management. Some people might go into a 23-hour bed and it might become clear that maybe they're withdrawing from multiple substances and that they need to go into an overnight bed. And then the third level of care is an intensive outpatient program. So one of the issues with withdrawal management centers or detox centers is a lot of people go to them, they get off the drug that they were using or alcohol, but they don't ever follow up with any treatment in the community. So what happens with a lot of them is that they go in and out of that revolving door multiple times. Some people are admitted to a withdrawal management type program 40 times, but they never go to any other treatment. So the idea behind having this step-down unit right there in the same place is that if somebody comes in, they're in a 23-hour bed, they get started on a replacement medication, even if they get discharged, they can come right back the next day with help, transportation. Ultimately, we're going to help with some housing support. They can come right back the next day and continue their treatment until they're stabilized and they make that transition to a regular outpatient program. So the hope is to stop that revolving door.
And now I know you guys provide services across the state. Do you see a lot of patients from the downstate area? Is there a need there?
Oh, yes. We do serve people statewide. We have, right now, we have four clinics in the community that do medication-assisted treatment for opioid disorders. And the biggest one is on Kirkwood Highway, but the second biggest one is in Millsboro on Route 113. So And it's pretty close to being as large as the one in Newark. So it serves 500-plus people a day. And when we first opened that clinic in Millsboro, people said to me, you're crazy, there's no demand, you're never going to be able to make this work. And initially, that's what it looked like. But over the last 2 years, every day we do intakes twice a week. We have 15 to 20 people every day that we do intakes there. So we knew from talking to the people there and also from talking to some people in western Sussex County like Seaford, Laurel, that area, that there was a pretty critical demand and very, very few services.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting the sort of way that ticked up. Is there a stigma around getting people to come into these centers? How do you bring folks in who, you know, maybe haven't sought treatment before? I mean, it's an addiction, and that can be hard to kind of convince.
Well, there's sort of stigma that goes both ways, unfortunately. So even the people who are willing and able to come and they want to come and, they come voluntarily, they're sort of stigmatized by other people in the community sometimes. You know, so sometimes the neighbors of those programs, businesses around them, think all sorts of things. I mean, but, you know, not the least of which is that they're criminals, that they're going to do something that's going to harm other people in the neighborhood. And, you know, the truth is that they're more likely to do that if they're untreated than if they're treated.
Do you have a sense yet of how many folks you're going to be treating on a, I guess, weekly basis or whatever it would be at this new center?
I'm guessing that they'll fill up by the weekend. And once it fills up, then people will cycle through and cycle down into the intensive outpatient program, and that will provide beds for additional people. I know yesterday afternoon on one of the country radio stations in Kent County, the radio announcer said, you know, the top three things you need to know today, and the number one was that the new detox center was open, and he gave out the number. So, you know, among the general public, there's a perception that there's a critical need. I was shocked when I heard that.
Yeah, and I know that the state and also the federal government gave you some help with this, too. Can you talk about the funding for the center?
Right. So originally, the state of Delaware, this is one of the governor's initiatives. Governor Markell is concerned about the addictions epidemic, and he asked the legislature, not this last session, but the session before, to allocate some funds to expand withdrawal management opportunities as well as outpatient opportunities. And then in this last legislative session, residential and sober living opportunities. And he was successful in getting the legislature to adopt those budgetary objectives. So, the state, typically, when they have money for services like this, put a request for proposals out, and, you know, we bid on this one and some others as well, and we're successful. So the state paid for some startup costs, and then they'll be paying through Medicaid or directly through the Department of Health and Social Services fees for service on a per diem basis for people who come into the program. In addition to that, we were successful in getting a USDA loan for a little bit more than $5 million to buy and renovate the facility.
Okay, so for folks, you know, who may be looking for this kind of treatment, what's the way they go about getting into your center?
It's open around the clock, and we do take admissions around the clock. People do have to be 18 to be able to go. And we do also have a strong, what we call, recovery coach component, which means that a number of the people who work there are people who themselves are in recovery and can really help people who are ready for that to figure out the way that they can best create a recovery program for themselves. It's safe and secure, medically monitored, clinically managed. There are doctors and nurses there all the time. So it's, you know, kind of a combination of that medical piece and the recovery coaching piece that, you know, people need the medical support to get through the actual withdrawal, but they really need the recovery coaching piece to figure out what their next steps are.
Yeah, so I imagine you kind of keep them in the system with the center for a period of time and then refer them to some of your other services as they go forward.
Right. So they go to that step-down unit if they're interested in doing that, or they can go on to residential treatment. But, you know, at the end of either residential or that step-down unit, they're ultimately going to end up going to someplace for outpatient treatment because it's a long-term recovery strategy. It takes a while.
Yeah, lifelong recovery in some cases.
It is a lifelong recovery process, right. And, you know, people go in and out of recovery, and, you know, our position is that we're always there and, you know, no harm, no foul. Our approach is harm reduction approach. You know, we want you to be as abstinent as you can for as long as you can and hopefully increase those periods of abstinence and decrease, you know, risky behaviors in the process.
Our thanks to Annie Ropeek and Kathy McKay of Connections Community, for their time this week. You can find details about the center's location and how to contact it at our website, DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with a new arts playlist after your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Artist Helen Farr Sloan is perhaps best known as the second wife of the realist painter and illustrator John Sloan. She dedicated most of her career to promoting the work of her husband, and thanks to her philanthropy, the Delaware Art Museum is home to the largest collection of his art. John Sloan was a leading figure of the Ashcan School of American Art, an early 20th century movement recognized for its depictions of urban scenes and everyday life. Sloan also created several portraits of his late wife, including Helen at the Easel, a painting which belongs to the Delaware Art Museum's permanent collection. But Helen Farr Sloan was a talented painter and printmaker in her own right. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter takes us to Wilmington for a look at the Delaware Art Museum's current exhibition of her work.
Born in New York City in 1911, Helen Farr Sloan displayed an early flair for drawing. As a teenager, she traveled to England with friends and stayed with Guy Wiggins, an American painter her mother knew from art school. In recognizing her talent in watercolors, Wiggins encouraged his old art school friend to allow her daughter to leave her privileged girls' school and study art full-time. At 16, Farr Sloan enrolled at the Art Students League of New York, where she met and studied with John Sloan. Heather Campbell Coyle, curator of American art at the Delaware Art Museum, says Farr Sloan was a serious student and took copious notes in her future husband's class.
Sloan generally did not like his students to do that because he found that they usually wrote things down that were wrong. But when he came around and noticed this, he said, "Well, you seem to be getting it right, so you can keep going." Eventually, Helen turned these notes, scrawled on the back and on the front of her drawings, into the book Gist of Drawing, which was really important in Sloan's career for communicating his ideas as a teacher to a broad audience.
By Farr Sloan's second year of study, John Sloan told his student that she was ready to leave school and start her career as a professional artist.
And that's when she begins in the late 20s and early 1930s to make these very ambitious pictures of New York in prints as well as in paintings. It's actually interesting that she does very little work after his death. I think he was crucial in encouraging her to keep working. By about 1962, she is rarely doing complete paintings. Most of the work in this show dates from the 1930s and 40s.
The 1930s were the most productive of Helen Farr Sloan's career. Like many of Sloan's students, the artist also gravitated to scenes of everyday life. There are several street scenes of New York in the current exhibition, including WPA Theater. It's a painting of a temporary venue set up in Washington Square Park as part of the Federal Theater Project, a New Deal program to fund theater and live performances during the Great Depression.
This picture of Helen's of the WPA Theater, it captures it from an interesting elevated point of view. She may have actually been at Sloan's studio that was right on the square when she saw this. It's captured in these very intense and not very realistic colors. By the 1930s, most American artists had begun to digest modernism, and they weren't necessarily trying to portray reality exactly as it was, right? It's a very stylized form of reality. And for Helen, this took the form of these really interesting, intense colors. So it's a city, but it's almost like a technicolor city.
Starting in the 1920s, many artists began traveling to the Southwest during the summers. In 1930, Helen Farr Sloan visited John Sloan and his first wife Dolly in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a locale that was becoming a favorite of New York City-based artists.
The other set of interesting work she does in Santa Fe are the prints. She trains at the Art Students League with several printmakers. She does a little bit of etching right around 1930, and there's a really beautiful etching in the exhibition from Santa Fe. But she does a lot more lithography. She had a very free kind of drawing style that lithography lent itself to better. So she does a lot more lithographs, which we also see a lot of in her series of Anya Enters, who is a modern dancer in New York.
Farris Sloan's work from her Santa Fe period is represented in several works in the current exhibition. The lithograph Apache Devil Dance depicts a Native American ceremony where dancers wear elaborate headdresses. Dance is a recurring theme in Farris Sloan's work. She produced a series of etchings and lithographs of the dancer Anya Enters.
Helen Farris Sloan, as well as John Sloan and several other modern artists in this period, get captivated with Miss Enters. Enters herself moved to New York to train at the Art Students League as a visual artist. At the same time, she was training to become a dancer. And she eventually becomes quite well known as what she calls herself is a dance mime. She kind of creates her own category. And Sloan encouraged her to do this. So this isn't just traditional forms of dance. And of course, this is in the 1920s in New York. So this is when modern dance is really flourishing. You have people like Isadora Duncan in the teens, and now you're seeing the legacy of that in the 1920s with artists like Enters, who would create these whole little vignettes. They were more like character sketches than traditional dances often. So some of the pictures of Enters, and I think there's about 10 of them in the show, will capture her in these very flamboyant costumes, which she designed and produced herself, and often in motion that has to do with the character, but also sometimes sitting or laying down, because this was all part of creating character as much as it was about creating a sense of movement.
After the death of John Sloan's first wife, Helen and John were married and painted side by side in New York and Santa Fe. After he died in 1951, Farris Sloan became a key resource for scholars and art leaders looking for information and art for exhibitions. One such curator was Bruce St. John, who worked at the Delaware Art Museum. Farris Sloan began donating works to the Wilmington Art Institution in the early 60s, and its current curator of American art says her philanthropy has left a major imprint on the museum.
It's not just in her own work that you see here, some of which did come from her estate, and others came from friends and family of hers. But it's also in the form of an extraordinary number of gifts. She settled the Sloan collection here, which is almost 2,600 works, paintings, prints, drawings by Sloan. But she also gave us about 1,800 other works by other artists. So works by people in Sloan's circle, but also she just went out, she would go out to auction and buy things that she thought we were interested in. So we have an extraordinary collection of French turn of the century posters that she collected for us. She bought us contemporary art. She bought us work by some of Sloan's interesting students like Mark Toby, who you might not expect, abstract expressionist artist. So her legacy here was really quite extraordinary.
Helen Farris Sloan eventually moved to Wilmington and kept a studio at the Howard Pyle Studios on Franklin Street. In 1998, she received the Governor's Award for the Arts in honor of her philanthropy. Helen Farris Sloan participated in the local art scene until her death in 2005 at the age of 94. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Kathy Carter.
And our thanks to Kathy Carter and Heather Campbell Coyle, curator of American art at the Delaware Art Museum. The Helen Farris Sloan exhibit is on view through January 10th. Stick around. Delaware Public Media science reporter Eli Chen joins us next to discuss new research that says we could see more nuisance flooding in the coming years. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. For most people, nuisance flooding is just an inconvenience, dealing with a flooded roadway during or just after a heavy rain. But as sea levels rise, this kind of flooding is likely to happen more often. And as Delaware Public Media's Eli Chen reports, new research says coastal areas like Delaware are especially susceptible to this continuing escalation.
Driving is a crucial part of Aaron Mifflin's job as a cable installer for Comcast. But getting around Delaware's coastal neighborhoods sometimes isn't easy. Mifflin says beachside roads like Cedar Street in Lewis has proved to be a navigational challenge when it floods.
There's really no side streets to go around it, so you either have to cancel the jobs or wait for it until it goes down or go through it if you can go through it.
And it's not just annoying. Mifflin has lived nearby in the town of Milton for 34 years, his whole life. And he says the flooding is bad for local businesses.
Yeah, a lot of businesses got ruined.
And he says he's been seeing more water on the roads lately than he's ever before. Mifflin's observations of more flooding on the streets, which is sometimes called nuisance or sunny day flooding, is on par with the trends that scientists are seeing in coastal communities. Decades ago, it used to be that you needed a pretty big storm to cause nuisance flooding. But now, a high tide can be all that it takes to see it in Delaware and in many other coastal areas, thanks to a combination of sea level rise and sinking landmass. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which uses records from a tide gauge in Lewis, the average number of nuisance flooding days a year was about 5 days in the early 1960s. 50 years later, that number has increased by 300% to an average of 22 days a year.
We are experiencing more frequent tidal flooding in the state of Delaware, and we should expect to see more of the same and deeper levels of flooding in the future.
That's Susan Love, the head of DENREC's Climate and Sustainability Section. In September, NOAA reported that some mid-Atlantic communities could see a record number of nuisance flooding days this year due to El Nino patterns, which send strong northeasterly winds into our region. In the report, NOAA says Lewis could expect 41 nuisance flooding days this year.
That is quite a lot of days during the year that will exceed that nuisance flooding level, where you'll see some water standing on roads.
In looking into the future, scientists recently published a study in the journal Geophysical Research Letters that looks at how sea level rise will affect nuisance flooding on the eastern seaboard by 2050. Co-author Amir Akakochak is a hydrologist at the University of California, Irvine.
With the expected projections, nuisance flooding will increase almost everywhere.
That increase will vary widely between about 10% and 270%, according to the study. Cities further inland, like Philadelphia, will experience a relatively small increase. Others, like Atlantic City, can expect more days of inconvenient flooding a year. Agakochek says, on average, the current rate at which seas are rising should increase 80% by 2050. That'll result in a 55% increase in nuisance flooding events. Because of what the data shows, he believes that coastal communities need to strongly consider the social, economic, and health impacts of increased flooding.
We need different groups of people, communities, stakeholders to think about all these projections and come up with ideas for adaptation, mitigation, and better planning to reduce our risk.
These kinds of stakeholder meetings and discussions have already started taking place in Delaware. Governor Jack Markell's Executive Order 41 also requires all state agencies to prepare the state for future effects of climate change. Jim Pappas, DelDOT's chief materials and research engineer, says planning long-term for an increasingly flooded future is a major priority for the agency.
There are going to be changes, and we need to be able to adapt very quickly.
But making roads more resilient, less flood-prone, is a challenge. Papa says one obvious way is to elevate roads. But that doesn't work everywhere, especially, say, marshy areas along Route 9.
If we add height to the road, or if we just, keep adding more pavement, it literally keeps sinking because the marsh underneath there is very, soft and spongy. So it's one of those things, you put more weight on top, and all you're doing is literally, because it's not on a firm base, it might be good for a short time, but that extra weight will actually cause the pavement to sink over time.
And another way is to improve the road's drainage system. Right now, DelDOT's able to use cameras to identify problematic roads, and they can replace or fix clogged pipes to make sure the water runs off the road. But Pappas adds that this type of short-term solution isn't effective in tidal areas.
Especially in Sussex County, as flat as it is, there's really no place to run the water. And so that's where the bigger challenge comes into working with our design programs to say, we need to either look to raise the road, work with DENREC to say, are there things that we can do creating wetland, buying property and creating wetland and things like that. More innovative, kind of outside-of-the-box thinking.
And using the local ecology, like building marshes and wetlands, could play a huge role in sustaining Delaware's transportation system. However, Pappas notes that lack of funding poses a major obstacle in executing these innovative, out-of-the-box solutions. And exactly how much nuisance flooding Delawareans can expect in the coming decades could also change over time, as scientists like Amir Akakochak continue to analyze climate and emissions data. But even as the projections fluctuate, experts all agree that flooding will only go up. Aaron Mifflin from Milton knows that beyond having to circumvent flooded streets sometimes, sea level rise is making it harder to afford coastal living.
You have to have a lot of money to actually live down here near the water. Even trying to buy a house around here, the flood insurance is going to be horrible.
And the data shows sea level rise will continue to make life in Delaware more difficult. The future for residents like Mifflin depends not only on what the scientists' projections can tell us, but most importantly, what the community decides to do because of them. Eli Chen, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Eli. And you can find this story and all of Eli's coverage of issues involving the environment, science, health, and technology anytime at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, this week's Enlighten Me. Stay with us on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Women are more likely to leave science, technology, engineering, and math careers early, contributing to a gender imbalance in those growing fields. It's what's known as the leaky pipeline of STEM. Now, a University of Delaware researcher has received $1.8 million from the National Science Foundation to study why it happens. Assistant psychology professor Chad Forbes is examining the subconscious effect that male-dominated classrooms can have on women's confidence. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Annie Ropeek spoke with Forbes to learn more about his research.
So your study looks at the impacts on women of what we call problem-based learning. So tell me, first of all, what that kind of looks like in a classroom.
So problem-based learning, it can take different forms, but one of the standard forms is children or you know, all the way up through college are placed in groups and like sitting around a table. And they are given some kind of problem or task that they're asked to solve. And so, yeah, we're looking at what effects groups of certain compositions might have for boys and girls in these different STEM contexts.
We hear a lot about stereotype threat in your research, you know, the idea that hearing a stereotype makes the victim of it feel that it's true, and then they kind of manifest it. It becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So how does that take shape in STEM?
So, yeah, so with respect to this kind of stuff, there's definitely a potential stereotype threat component, but stereotype threat is actually kind of a subcomponent of what we call these more like kind of general identity threats, which are just, you know, these fears that people can have a lot of different fears, basically, in these different contexts, where, you know, they might fear, for instance, that just, you know, while they're interacting with somebody, that that person is going to perceive them in this kind of stereotype consistent manner. We call that like a social identity threat. There's women may have a fear that other women in the group might actually make them look bad, kind of look as if they are collectively confirming this negative stereotype. We call that collective threat. And then stereotype threat is specific to like performance situations or evaluative situations. And so these things can be triggered really, really easily and subtly. In STEM context in particular, essentially when women or girls are outnumbered by boys, right? So that kind of makes gender salient, having male instructors, things like that, posters on the wall that depict, you know, maybe disproportionate amounts of men and women or boys and girls, you know, in these kind of laboratory contexts. So there's lots of different things that can trigger the salience of these stereotypes. And a lot of these things are outside of the conscious awareness of these individuals. So they don't necessarily realize that they're outnumbered, or they don't necessarily realize that, you know, these posters might be depicted in a certain way. But that's enough to kind of trigger these things in general.
So STEM is a male-dominated field. And I mean, it's interesting you say you may not even be aware that these things are being triggered. I mean, how do you combat this in a classroom setting where, you know, even all other things being equal, there probably will be more men sitting at that problem-based learning table? What is your research kind of telling you should change?
We know, for instance, that like just telling women about these phenomena, like telling them about stereotype threat or social identity threat, can be really helpful in buffering them from the deleterious consequences of it. We focus a lot in our studies on the role of positive memories and positive experiences within the domain, in part because we think that these contexts may promote like kind of a bias or disproportionate remembering of negative experiences in particular, and that's just kind of a product of the nature, you know, the environment itself and like the stressors that individuals experience. So we're tinkering with those kinds of things, and actually some of our research has provided some evidence that these contexts are actually aversive to women, not unlike, you know, someone might develop an aversion towards like spiders or snakes, like it's an actual biological aversion that we can actually blunt out. So when we can use these kind of popular tools in like clinical psychology that they use to basically blunt, you know, phobic responses, like spider phobic responses to spiders, we can do the same thing with women by showing them, you know, getting them to kind of attend away from pictures of men in lab coats and things like that.
It's interesting. You kind of have to work around the fact that for at least the short term, there will continue to be more men, you know, before you can start to have that ripple effect happen where women stay in STEM longer and it ends up evening out. You have to hide them from the posters before there are more women on the posters. That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we have these debates a lot. There's other interesting tools like tricks that can be done too. But that was kind of the point was like, well, you know, we've got to plug up the leaks in the pipeline, right? And increase that, you know, that sample size or that pool of women in the STEM fields. Like that needs to happen first and foremost before you can kind of evoke these more palatable options, I guess. But yeah, it's hard because the fact is, you know, women leave at disproportionate levels, and so you got to like put the stopgap in there first. So like a lot of people want these things to happen now, but yeah, those things take time.
Thanks to UD Assistant Professor Chad Forbes and our Annie Ropeek for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. A reminder that the stories and interviews you've heard over the past 60 minutes are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We're also looking for your feedback and story ideas, so connect with us on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, Eli Chen, James Dawson, and Annie Ropeek, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them, I'm Tom Byrne, saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.